This event has changed a lot of things, and I think it has already influenced the debate on migration in Europe. It's unavoidable that there will be, you know, more emphasis on border security and more emphasis on the security threat from supposed security threat from refugees and migrants already inside Europe. So, and on this topic, as other topics related to migration, we need to ensure that the debate is based on evidence and robust analysis. So I can think of really no other area where the distance between the what we know in terms of data, in terms of analysis, and the public debate is greater. And maybe at this particular point in time, this is particularly important. So we have at LSE, we have formed an initiative on migration. We call the Global Migration Initiative, which engages researchers and actually students as well across all of LSE. And we have more than 40 researchers now working on migration. We have also initiated an alliance of universities in Europe and probably beyond. We had our first meeting today to discuss what we can do together. Because again, it's about producing evidence and making sure that this evidence is reflected in the public debate and in the policies that are pursued. And we also know that when we talk about climate, it's a similar issue, that there are a lot of propositions and suggestions out there that are not founded in serious analysis. And of course, when you link up these topics, migration and climate, they having evidence and having the solid research behind is particularly important. So we have a fantastic group of panelists tonight, and I will soon hand over the floor to Nick Stern, mentor and colleague, and he has kindly agreed to introduce the panel and chair to this evening's conversation. We are tremendously grateful to Mary Robinson and Alain Leroy and Neil Adger for joining us tonight. And before I hand over the floor to Nick, I want to give the floor to the Her Excellency Sylvie Berman. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Well, dear Mary Robinson, Lord Stand, cher Nick, and Mr. Secretary General, cher Alain, dear Professor Adger, dear Professor Bergloff, and distinguished friends. It's a really serious issue that brings us together today, the question of migration in the context of environmental change, and more specifically its effects across the gateway to Europe, which is the Mediterranean region. And as say, it seems obvious now that it is a very important issue, but in fact, a few years ago, it seemed to be a non-issue because nobody was ready to talk about climate, refugees, and the consequences. So I can't say I'm glad it has changed, but at least that we recognize the issue. And we know that environmental change will affect migration now and in the future, and we also know the range and complexity of the interactions between all the economic, social, and political drivers of migration. It will rarely be possible to distinguish genuine environmental migrants. I'm very glad to welcome all those brilliant panelists to address this very complex issue, and they will help us to understand the problem. I would like to say a few words about the very near future, because in now less than 2 weeks, France will begin hosting the COP21, and the French Prime Minister has confirmed that this major summit will go ahead, despite Friday's deadly terrorist attacks. Unfortunately, concerts and festive events, as well maybe as a few civil society initiatives, are likely to be called off. But no country has asked France to postpone the summit. The whole country in France is mobilized in the run-up to this landmark meeting for our civilization. And France, who will co-chair the conference with the UNFCCC, is determined to reach an agreement in Paris. And we believe that COP21 is on course to becoming a turning point in the history of climate change. Of course, nothing should be taken for granted until the very end. And one of the reasons for the relative failure of the Copenhagen meeting was the lack of involvement of the major political leaders. It is not the case anymore. Everybody, or maybe not everybody, but major leaders are really committed, and not only leaders, but also cities and non-governmental actors, which is very important. And so France has chosen to invite the heads of state and government to attend a special opening session, and more of them will be present to give their guidelines and directives to the negotiators. And before giving the floor to Lord Stern, who will be our chair tonight, I would like to thank warmly, well, of course, all the speakers, but also the LSE, because we've done a lot of work with the LSE regarding climate change. This is a major partner for us, and I would like to thank also the European Commission, who is co-organizing it with us. So this is the last of the four conferences the French Embassy has organized on different issue on the run-up to the COP21. Well, I'm looking forward to hear you, but also your question and questions and debate. As I said, the COP21 will be a turning point. It won't be the end of the process, of course, but the beginning of a new process. So I guess we have many other opportunities to work again with the LSE and to organize other such meetings. So thank you very much to all of you.
Thank you very much, Madame Ambassador Chère Sylvie. It's an honour to have you with us. I'd like to join with Eric in expressing our solidarity, our fraternité with all of you in France on this very difficult and special time. I'm sure, like many people here, I rang some of my closest friends on Saturday morning. I confess they were all academics at the Collège de France and Polytechnique and so on. And I was hugely impressed by their measured calmness that came with the outrage. It also came that calmness and solidity and strength. And that's what we see in France, and that's what we admire so much. So on behalf of all of us at the LSE, our expressions of solidarity and very deepest good wishes. And we do that, of course, by, as you described so clearly, you carry on. And that's exactly what you're doing and what will happen with the COP. There have been a lot of groups involved in this, and I think that's extremely cheerful. There's the LSE European Institute, the LSE Institute for Global Affairs, which Eric presides over. There's the LSE Grantham Research Institute, which I chair. So there's three LSE elements, the Embassy of France in the United Kingdom, and the European Commission representation in the UK. So I think there's strength in numbers there, but thank you to all who were involved in that. Those of you who like to Twitter can Twitter, and the hashtag is #LSECOP21.
I think it's 21.
tweet, those of you like to tweet, through the facility supplied by Twitter, can do your tweeting on the Twitter platform. You've got two grandparents. you can see which is the more advanced. But it's also one of the reasons why we take this subject so seriously. I'm just the chair, but let me just say a word or two about the stakes, because as we think about this, often people lose track or don't appreciate just how big all this is. We've grown up as a civilization in the Holocene period, the period since the warming up after the last ice age, last 7,000 or 8,000 years. And that's the period where we cultivated grass and it became cereals. So we sat down because we had to wait for the cereals to grow. And so we had villages and we had a surplus so we could have universities and diplomatic corps and so on. This is the society that we know, and it's young, 7,000 or 8,000 years, and it's plus or minus 1 degree centigrade in global average surface temperature. We're already at the edge, of that. 3 degrees, which we're quite likely headed for, unless we act still more strongly than seems the case at the moment, that we have a good chance of avoiding 3 degrees, and Paris is going to be a big step on the way, but 3 degrees would be a temperature we haven't seen for 3 million years. 3 million. Yeah. And we've been around Homo sapiens, 250,000. Generous notion of sapiens, probably. But basically, our society is much younger than that. It's the last I said. We're already on the edge. So it's important to realise the stakes that we're playing for, and why Paris is so important, and why millions believe that Paris will be a turning point from which we'll accelerate. But that kind of thing rewrites the relationship between human beings and the planet. We live where we live because of where the water is, where the seas are, where the ports are, where the river crossings are, whether the climate permits the growing of different kinds of crops. We live where we live, and we do what we do in large measure where we do it, because of the structure of the climate, particularly around water. And if you rewrite the relationship between human beings and the planet in the way that I've just begun to describe, people will move. And that is the subject that we're talking about. And they may move on a grand scale, on a scale that we've never seen before. So this is a very big issue. We're in Europe, so migration to Europe is the focus of the day. But this is going to be migration on a world scale, including to Europe and within Europe. So that's our subject. My old friend Mary Robinson will give the initial remarks, and Mary is the former president of Ireland and currently president of the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice. And then Alain Leroy, the Secretary General of the European External Action Service, that's the foreign service of the EU, not the European Commission, it's the foreign service of the EU. And Alain Leroy, Secretary General of that. And then we'll have Professor Neil Adger, who's Professor of Human Geography at the University of Exeter. I said I wouldn't add anything to their CVs beyond what I've just said. And if there's anything that's absolutely critical in their intellectual and personal, political, economic, financial careers that they want to bring in, of course, absolutely share it with us. But the distinction is already clear from what I've already said. So we're very fortunate to have this panel. So that's enough from me. Mary, could you open up for us, please?
Okay. Thank you very much, Nick, and it really is a pleasure to be back at LSE, where I've participated in a number of lively discussions on climate justice in recent years. And I'm glad to be once again under your thumb or under your jurisdiction, Nick. As has already been said, this meeting takes place in the grim aftermath of the terrible attacks in Paris on the 13th of November. But more than ever before, we have to be true to our values and to our commitments. I do want to actually add a personal note at this stage. I have a very special relationship with Paris because I went there from 6 years of a convent school in Dublin at the age of 17 and spent a year in Paris that kind of changed my life, certainly changed my outlook. And I fell in love with Paris, and I've had that love affair ever since. So it was very devastating to see the scenes. But there are scenes that are familiar in other parts of the world that don't get the same coverage, and we have to remember that as well. And I think that's very important. I also very much admire the French leadership leading us towards COP21, and I've worked very closely in my capacity as the Special Envoy at the Secretary General with Laurent Fabius and Laurence Dubiana and Ségolène Royal and indeed President Hollande himself. And I think I believe that there will be a lot of recognition of French leadership, and there will be probably a mood of trying to help to build on that. I hope that will be the case. As many of you probably know by now, it's the injustice of the impacts of climate change and the resulting undermining of human rights that drives me to work on climate justice. We can't tolerate a world where people who already live in vulnerable circumstances due to poverty, gender or race are further disadvantaged by the impacts of climate change, a global problem that they bear very little responsibility for. There is a real injustice which we must always keep in mind. Tonight we're focusing our minds on migration and climate change, two very topical issues given the current migration crisis in Europe and the upcoming climate change summit in Paris. And both, I believe, have been affected in ways that we're still trying to assess. It's hard to assess so early by what happened recently in Paris and its aftermath. When a crisis happens, it elicits a response. As many commentators have noted, the current migration crisis is a forewarning of what is to come. A growing world population, increasing resource scarcity, and rising global temperatures will amplify the social, economic, and political factors that drive migration. So it's wise to take a long-term view when responding to the current crisis, because it's likely to be the start of a longer-term strategy to manage human mobility. Human migration is a journey by people from one place to another to settle temporarily or permanently in a new location. All journeys have a start, a beginning, and an end. All journeys have a reason, a purpose, and the best journeys are well-planned, complication-free and safe from the very beginning to the final destination. The fundamental tools for ensuring that human migration is a safe journey are, in fact, human rights. Human rights ensure dignity, and to be successful, migration must be with dignity. Human rights, from procedural rights such as participation and access to information, to substantive rights, such as the rights to food, water and shelter, are the safeguards we enjoy as individuals when we move voluntarily or as a last resort. Migration with dignity is the message carried by President Tong of Kiribati, of the Republic of Kiribati. I shared a panel with him earlier this year at the Human Rights Council, and he again made an impassioned plea to the international community to support his country to adapt to the impacts of climate change. Island atolls like Kiribati are vulnerable even in a below 2 degrees world. At current levels of warming, these island nations are already vulnerable to food security, water and energy insecurity, as well as sea level rise and extreme weather events. The migration which President Tong is preparing for is migration of last resort. And I've reflected on this in a TED talk, which some of you may have seen, because I didn't have to deal with a problem like that as president. It wouldn't have occurred to me that I would have to buy land in Europe because Ireland was going under because of climate change. It just wasn't a problem to be coped with. I never anticipated that any world leader would have to relocate their whole country or their whole population during my lifetime. Likewise, when Eleanor Roosevelt and her commission drew up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 in Paris, it would have been unimaginable that whole countries would go out of existence because of human-induced climate change. The same applies to the 1951 Refugee Convention and even its 1967 Protocol. The governments that drew up these agreements could never have imagined that climate change would trigger the displacement and migration of people. We now need to use the benefit of hindsight to design a new climate regime that's grounded in human rights and informed by science so that it stands the test of time. The only way to avoid the type of last resort migration the Republic of Kiribati is planning for is to act now to phase out carbon emissions, hopefully by 2050. Hence the vital importance of the Paris Agreement. To set this objective in a legal agreement and to ensure that the measures to make the objective a reality, access to finance, technology, and capacity building, are made available so that all countries can deliver ambitious climate actions. And to make sure that we don't leave our human rights commitments outside the door when we design climate actions, we need to frame the agreement in human rights so that people are empowered and engaged rather than excluded and disenfranchised. This transition away from fossil fuels and to renewable energy and from deforestation to sustainable land use can also have a positive impact on poverty eradication and the quality of people's lives. If we make sure that the policies and actions taken are informed by and consistent with human rights, what we can't and shouldn't do is to set human rights obligations aside in the rush to combat climate change. We may get to a stage where we will panic and make land grabs, and some of that is happening already, displace people because we want to reduce emissions because suddenly we know how serious it is, as Nick has told us. But we must never lose sight of the fact that climate change is about people, and our responses to it must be fair and people-centred. Sustainable development and adaptation to climate change are the building blocks that can help people to stay in their areas of origin. Together, they create the conditions needed for human well-being, a livelihood, access to education and health, a safe environment, and a society where people participate in decision-making and are protected by the rule of law. Hence, the Paris Agreement needs to pay equal attention to adaptation and recognise the links to the Sustainable Development Goals, which will also deliver climate action on the ground. There are other forms of migration, less desperate journeys than those facing the people of Kiribati, that are also in part motivated by climate change, and in many cases constitute an adaptation to climate change. The movement of members of a family from a rural area affected by drought or floods to cities to find a new source of income is one example. The movement of whole families to another region or city to find a new life is another, and the migration of some family members overseas to earn remittances and send them home is another. These strategies must be understood and planned for as part of adaptation planning as envisaged in the Cancun Adaptation Framework. We also know that there are limits to adaptation and that the migration of last resort that President Tong speaks of is part of what we refer to in the climate negotiations as loss and damage. The Warsaw International Mechanism for Loss and Damage associated with climate change impacts addresses climate risks, including human mobility, and is another important forum for discussions on migration, displacement, and forced relocation in the context of climate change. The least developed countries and other negotiating groups are calling for loss and damage to be part of the Paris Agreement to place this issue on an equal footing with mitigation and adaptation. No matter the motivation or the distance, the protection of people's rights along the course of their journey and in the place they relocate to is of utmost importance. The tragedies we witnessed this year in the Mediterranean are due to the lack of these protections, and from this we must learn and be motivated to do better. Migration is also part and parcel of human development. It has informed how civilizations have developed, and it allows for the rich cultural exchanges that colour our lives. Migration can be a very positive thing. I've seen generations of Irish people emigrate, maybe initially out of desperation, but also, in many cases, out of a desire to see the world, to learn, and to explore. Over time, they've sent home remittances, they've returned home with new ideas and skills, or they've supported the country's development as an engaged diaspora. The 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the 17 Sustainable Development Goals make a commitment to leave no one behind. That language is very strong in the SDGs, leave no one behind. As with human rights, this places an emphasis on the individual and implies that SDGs apply to all people, whether they are in their country of origin, in transit, or at their destination. The 2030 Agenda recognises migration as a positive force for sustainable development, and it promotes the rights and well-being of migrants. Paragraph 29 recognises the positive contribution of migrants to inclusive growth and sustainable development, and mentions full respect for human rights and the humane treatment of migrants, regardless of migration status. Paragraph 14 notes that forced displacement is a threat to development progress, and paragraph 23 recognises migrants, refugees, and internally displaced persons amongst vulnerable people. In addition, the targets for goals 8, 10, and 17 address migration. The universal nature of Action 2030, the fact that it applies to all countries, reminds us that migration, like climate change and sustainable development, is a challenge for all countries. These are issues that require countries to act on their own borders and to cooperate on internationally. And this was picked up in the Addis Ababa Action Agenda, agreed at the Third International Conference on Financing for Development, which spells out actions to ensure safe, orderly, and regular migration, with full respect for human rights, regardless of their status. All countries have responsibility to protect human rights, just as all countries have responsibility now to deliver on the Sustainable Development Goals. This applies to European countries in just the same way as it applies to developing countries, and no one can shirk their responsibility. Human mobility in the context of climate change is a climate justice issue. It illustrates the important linkages between the climate change, sustainable development, and human rights. Migration rarely occurs as a direct effect of climate change. It's motivated by a range of issues that are environmental, social, and economic. So addressing migration as a climate, development, or human rights issue alone is unlikely to be effective. Instead, responses need to be found across the international processes, addressing these issues and translated into actions on the ground at the regional and national level. Climate change safeguards the rights and opportunities of the most vulnerable people, and so highlights the particular vulnerability of women migrants, and I hope we can come back to that in the discussion. But it also highlights their agency and their solutions when their participation in decision-making is ensured. The principles of climate justice can inform a comprehensive approach to human mobility in the context of climate change. They call for respect for human rights, including the right to development, for gender equality, and for participation, transparency, and accountability in decision-making. These principles inform the actions all countries should undertake to implement the Sustainable Development Goals, to ensure human rights protections for their citizens, and to both mitigate and adapt to climate change. To form an effective response to human mobility in the context of climate change, we need to step out of the silos that traditionally separate human rights, sustainable development, climate change, humanitarian response, and disaster risk reduction, amongst others, to find coherent approaches that trigger actions across all these disciplines and policy areas. So in implementing Agenda 2030 in the coming years, all countries need to integrate actions related to migration into their policies across the full range of the SDGs. In implementing climate actions related to adaptation and mitigation, countries will have to fully respect human rights to ensure migration, displacement, and planned relocation with dignity. And this is why it's so critical to have a human rights framing to the Paris Agreement, to ensure that the human rights obligations each country is committed to inform all climate actions and ensure that both people and the planet benefit from climate actions. We can't have an important UN agreement on climate change that ignores human rights. But there are some who feel human rights isn't necessary in the agreement. And what would they say about us if that was the result? Failing to respect human rights only undermines our humanity, and saving humanity is what the climate agreement is all about. The Human Rights Council will, I believe, play a role in consolidating and strengthening the provisions for people who move in response to factors, including climate change. At present, legal gaps at the international, regional, and national level mean that people are vulnerable to exploitation and have their rights undermined along their migration pathways and in their new locations, whether that's a city slum in their own country or a new country on a foreign shore. The protection agenda produced by the Nansen Initiative identified some of these gaps and proposes action states can take to address them. The next step will be to develop responses to these gaps at the international and national levels. We know from the science presented in the IPCC fifth assessment report that climate change is projected to increase displacement of people and can increase it very dramatically if we don't take the right steps. So knowing that climate change will affect human mobility and that it will pose particular challenges for people who lack resources, it makes sense to plan for this now as an adaptation strategy, as part of sustainable development, and with human rights guiding the actions all countries take. The IPCC also highlights the risks climate change poses to human security. The fifth assessment report finds that human security will be progressively threatened as the climate changes, and it supports the assessment that climate change is a threat multiplier, stating that human insecurity almost never has single causes, but instead emerges from the interaction of multiple factors. Climate change is an important factor threatening human security through 1, undermining livelihoods, 2, compromising culture and identity, 3, increasing migration that people would rather have avoided, and 4, challenging the ability of states to provide the conditions necessary for human security. Addressing the causes of climate change is therefore a response to growing human insecurity, as is safeguarding human rights, empowering people to secure their own lives, and increasing accountability. Human mobility in the context of climate change will affect all countries with knock-on effects on human security. An effective approach to managing this mobility will require international cooperation, including support for developing countries that lack the resources to plan for migration with dignity. All countries, whether countries of origin or destination, will be in a climate-disruptive world. And so countries with internally displaced people will need to work together to share experiences and plan effective responses. Human security requires the rule of law and a just social and political order. These are also requirements for effective climate action and sustainable development. All of these agendas need policy responses that manage and balance our increasing interdependence and our increasing vulnerability. I want to say something about the reaction in Paris. The initial response to the terrorist attacks in Paris has been to say that Paris is at war and will respond with full vigour against ISIS that has claimed responsibility for the attacks. In many ways, this reminds me of the response of President Bush to the attacks of 9/11, declaring war on terrorism. In my capacity as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights at the time, I pleaded with the United States to take the criminal route, declaring the terrorist acts as crimes against humanity that should be punished by a united front of all countries, bringing the perpetrators to justice. To declare a war against terrorism had the consequence of undermining human rights, core human rights, and also encouraging young people who felt excluded from hope to be radicalized into being at war with the United States and other Western countries. Being at war gives terrorists who have committed terrible criminal acts a status they don't deserve. So an important first step is to address terrorism as a totally criminal act and bring the perpetrators to justice, using all the means necessary to do so. But the next step falls squarely back into the realm of sustainable development, is to deliver Agenda 2030 and realize the sustainable development goals in all countries so that we give hope and opportunity to everyone. That's the way to end radicalization. And of course, as climate change is a threat multiplier, we need to act now to get it under control so that as we make progress on countering terrorism and eliminating poverty and injustice, we don't then face a new wave of instability promoted by resource scarcity and extreme weather events. And in taking action on climate change, we must be guided, as I've emphasized, by human rights so that we don't inadvertently create exclusion or disenfranchise the people that will be the drivers of a global transformation. We need at this critical point that we all know to believe in and to live the values of freedom and democracy. Our challenge is to work through the sustainable development goals and a robust fair climate agreement to give hope to people that they have the right to development and to a better life. I want to end with a brief anecdote about somebody that I admire greatly but also am extremely fond of, and that is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I'm an elder, and he was chair of the elders for a number of years. And we were together in New York about 3 years ago on a panel. And the panel had an audience like this, an audience of young people. And when Archbishop Tutu is in front of young people, he gets very excited and very enthusiastic, and he says all the things he says. And there was a woman journalist who was presiding over this, and she said to him quite sharply, "Archbishop Tutu, why are you such an optimist?" And he turned to her and said, "Oh no, dearie," and he called her dearie, "Oh no, dearie," and said, "I'm not an optimist. I'm a prisoner of hope." And, you know, there are times when we all have to be prisoners of hope, but put the emphasis on hope. Thank you very much.
Tremendous leadership in this whole area of climate rights, justice, and rights come in very strongly wherever you look, but in this area, surely the reasons you described are particularly strongly. You gave the Desmond Tutu, I can't resist, because Sylvie and I were with Yann Arthus-Bertrand, who's made this wonderful movie called Human. He does the pictures of us from above, and he made a wonderful movie from home called Home, which is tremendous, largely about the environment, just one's different. And somebody, after a little discussion after the movie, and somebody said to him, "How come you're optimistic, Jan?" And his remark was, "It's too late to be pessimistic." French profundity, I thought. So now we have Anna Le Roy, the Secretary General of the European External Action Service. Please, Anna, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Nicola. Thank you very much, Murray, for an extremely insightful intervention. But before speaking of climate change and migration, we need to make two small points. First of all, I'm a European diplomat. I'm also a French citizen, and I'm a safer. What happened yesterday night in Wembley, hearing the Marseillaise song in English by such a young crowd. It was, I think, had never happened before. It was a fantastic emotion. So you can tell. I think even from Brussels, where I was, the emotion of the solidarity of the British people was so obvious and so extraordinary. So thank you very much for that support that all Frenchies have received from the British people. And another example of solidarity was yesterday in Brussels, there was a council, European Council of the Defence Ministers, and French requested to invoke a clause which is called 42.7, so one clause of the treaty, which is called clause of mutual assistance. And I must say the British Defence Minister, together with the German Minister, were the first to say, of course we'll support any assistance that France will require for any military operation, any operation against terrorist activity. The word war was not used, but military activities was used. Another example of fantastic great British solidarity towards France and towards French people, I would say. Second point, you said EES, I think nobody knows what EES, the European External Action Service, I just want to say what it is, because maybe in the future some of you would be interested to work in that. It's in fact a European diplomatic service called the European External Action Service. It's created by the Lisbon Treaty. It's the foreign ministry of the EU. It's also foreign and defense ministry, because we do both. Created in the 1st of January 2011, and our task is to try to have common EU to reach common EU position on all international crises, on Ukraine, the sanctions towards Russia, on Syria, on Libya, on all the main international crises. That's the European External Service. I stop here, and I come now to the migration and climate change. And before, because of climate change, you said it, Maria Benson. It's a warning of what could happen. And as I said, working within the EU institution, the warning is already extremely difficult to tackle. So we are overwhelmed. Just the figures on migration as of today. By the end of the year, there will be around 1 million migrants who have come to Europe, compared to a few years ago, it was something like 200,000 or 300,000. And it's continuing, as you see, usually. At this stage, mostly through the Western Balkan route, but it's raised a huge, huge problem within the EU. And maybe you've heard, of course, already with this figure, which, as you say, with climate change, sometimes people think of 20 million displacements in the future, not all for Europe, but 20 million displaced people, or 1 million people coming to Europe, I would say, I see that very much. The sentence you hear from leaders, It's an existential crisis for the EU. Schengen is at risk, so it's a huge, and I must say, so far what we try to be done by the EU, especially by the President of the EU Commission, President Juncker, is to try what two mechanisms, which are, one is called relocation, the other one is resettlement, is to ensure we have some kind of a normal burden sharing within European countries. But that is very difficult. For 1 million, there has been an agreement, very difficult to obtain, to relocate 160,000 among the European countries. UK has knocked out of that, since it was not forced to do it, but they voluntarily proposed some kind of relocation scheme. Relocation means taking migrants or asylum seekers or refugees, mostly those, asylum seekers, from the country where they arrive, mostly Greece and Italy, and to bring them another part of Europe. 160,000, that was extremely difficult, it was a vote within the European Council, which doesn't happen very often, so it was not unanimous, we had to vote, and some countries were defeated, and so they had to agree despite their will. And for that, for 160,000, we still are very... That was adopted maybe 1 month or 2 months ago, and still the figure for relocation today is something like less than 1,000. So it's already extremely difficult. And the second one is resettlement. Resettlement is the fact that we transfer refugees who are already not within the EU, in other countries, and usually neighboring where the crisis is. And all that, for that, we have also a scheme. That, even that is also extremely complicated. And just to give you also some figures, because the one we deal on a daily basis, I said 1 million are coming into Europe this year, both through the Mediterranean route and through the Western Balkan route. But the figures just for the Syrian crisis, the figures of people displaced within Syria are 7 million, the figures UNHCR, and the refugees outside Syria are already over 4 million. In Turkey, there are something like 2.2 million. There are 1.3 million in Lebanon, and there are 0.9 million in Jordan, a very small country. For example, just to see the figure, in Lebanon, I was discussing with the Foreign Minister of Lebanon the other day, in Lebanon, there are schools now these days where there are more Syrian children than Lebanon children. And you know the state of Lebanon, which is not the best organized or the most the richest country. as you know, we are these days, and very much on the topic, discussing heavily with Turkey, because Turkey, with 2 million refugees, could decide that they cannot sustain this number of refugees anymore, and they want to send them to Europe, it's very easy, to Greece. And for example, everyone say we have to protect our external borders, but then the Greek foreign minister is telling us, between the Turkish coast and the Samos island, for example, in Greece, it lasts less than 1 minute for a boat leaving the Turkish coast to reach the border, the maritime border between Greece and Turkey. And once they have reached the border, they cannot be repelled to where they come. So how to protect the external borders without full cooperation of Turkey, it's a big issue. And now we are, in these coming days, there might be a summit between all EU head of state and government and Turkey in the coming weeks to try to tackle this issue, to try to have an agreement with Turkey. And that Turkey is, you maybe have seen that in the press, as making big requests. They request, for example, 3 billion euro per year. They request, of course, many opening of many chapters on the accession process. So it's a very, very big challenge. And I say that because it's a warning. It's a warning that is already extremely difficult to tackle with on a daily basis within the European Union. And how to support Lebanon, how to support Jordan, that's also very complicated. How to support also Serbia and Fyrom, and Macedonia, where they are going through. It's a huge challenge already. And now that's, and the vast majority of these refugees are coming due to conflict. I said the Syrian, but the Syrian, as Marie knows that very well, part of the Syrian refugees are due, of course, mostly to the conflict. But the conflict was also aggravated by the refugees were as aggravated. There was a drought in Syria that has aggravated that movement. So that's where we are, and I gave you the figures, and now we will come to, in addition to all that, climate change. I gave the figure of 20 million, so the figures of, I think you know, but I was saying, of course, all the conflicts. Conflicts mostly are coming from Syria, Eritrea, Somalia, Afghanistan, but also some are coming economic migrants from different, from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and of course of West Africa. You have seen the EU answer. The EU answer, of course, came for the West, for the Mediterranean route. There was also decided to launch what we call a CSDB, or European military operations, called Operation Sophia, with the first objective to try to save life at sea, because you remember that you may know that for the timing, and just in 2015, more than 3,500 people have died in the sea, either in the Mediterranean, in the Western Mediterranean, coming from Libya, or between Turkey and Greece, 3,500 people have died. So the EU also was first to launch an operation with Navy ships to ensure at least first people, much less people die at sea, and also to fight against the smuggler and the traffickers. That's the Operation Sophia that we are doing with, and it's an EU operation. The UK is participating with a ship called the Blue Book, and that's very good. Among the conflicts, some of them also were if we speak from Mali or Darfur or Syria, enfin, Darfur was very clear. The climate change angle was also quite important to aggravate the displacement of the population. So that's where we are with the vast majority of the conflict, but aggravated by climate. And now, if we take into account the obvious development of the climate environment, the aggravation of the climate environment, the figures will be much higher. You said it, Nicolas, that the average temperature now is. If we reach 3 degrees, it was never so high. 3 million years ago, I think the figure is very important. And the control of resources has become a major source of instability in many parts of the world. The conflict in the Sahel was caused by, as I said, multiple factors, including. We can think, of course, of desertification and its impact on the economy of the Sahel region. Drought and desertification pushed thousands of people into hunger and poverty. And we all know so. Demonstrated it many times, poverty is a major push towards human mobility. And I always remember something that Mr. Antonio Guterres, the head of UNHCR, was telling me 1 month ago. The day he made a very clear point that the day where the major part of the Syrian refugee flow started was exactly the day of the week where the funding for WFP and UNHCR stopped. So, and that's the continent was absolutely clear, and it's clear. So, desertification, drought, and lack of food, clearly, WFP, so the World Food Program, didn't have enough sufficient money. The same week, the big flow of refugees started. So, yeah. And then also a link to that, maybe has been said for the time being, you know what the demography in Africa will be, 2050, something like 2 billion Africans with desertification and a limited number of job creations, so the pressure will be, of course, increasing a lot. About Africa development, I will advise you a book which was done in 2005 by Sir Nicolas Stern about Africa to prepare for the G8 in Glasgow. I remember that very well. It's still extremely valid today, I would say. It's still, okay. So, I'll speak of the SDG. You mentioned that, I think, very clear. Some other figures. For example, just 60% of Bangladesh is less than 50 meters above the sea level. 60%, so less than 5 meters. The country is, of course, vulnerable to storms, erosion, sedimentation. And of course, any kind of climate change which is affecting agriculture, water, food security. And on top of that, for example, 7 out of 10 biggest towns in the world are seaport. And also, they can be affected in some ways by climate change, including New York, for example. Another figure, 30% of the world population is living on littorals, and 2 billion people in area threatened by desertification. 2 billion people, so it's, that does, the impact would be absolutely vast. And again, I quote UNHCR. And IOM, the International Organization for Migration, has the same figure. They estimate that migration caused by climate change might be multiplied by 5 by 2025, UNHCR figures. Of course, that's a projection. It will happen, that's a forecast. And last week, there was in Malta a summit between all head of state and government of the EU and all head of state and governments of Africa, I would say, West, Central, and Eastern Africa, not Southern Africa, because they were, because the topic was migration. How to discuss migration with the African leaders. And I would encourage you to read the action plan, which was here. So you can see the EU, you're part of the EU, you can find all these documents. And all head of state, they signed a document called an action plan, and I read one of the commitments they have all made. So all head of state of the EU and all head of state of Western, Central, and Eastern Africa agreed. We agreed to address environment, that was last week, address environmental and climate change issues in the most affected regions, including through adaptation to climate change and development of sustainable and renewable energies, notably their consensual electrification projects. They also provide satellite data and information, Copernicus program, which is an EU program for image of the Earth, to support rural development, the improvement of food security, and the management of natural resources in a sustainable way. And with this conference last week in Malta on migration, it's clear that climate change was a big part of that conference, was created, funded by the EU, a trust fund of 1.8 billion euro, signed again, there was a signing ceremony, it was all EU head of state and government, to try to develop projects to mitigate the cause of migration, of course, and a big part was linked to climate change. It was interesting to see to discuss again in Malta last week with some leaders of Africa. I have in mind the president of Ivory Coast saying that to mitigate the impact of climate change and deforestation, his plan to have, of course, to develop much more rural development, much more infrastructure, and also electrification. He said, by the end of next year, he will have put electricity in all villages over 500 inhabitants. That I think it's we have a rooting part. If you have electricity, you can have a fridge, you can fight against the warmth of the temperature. So that was, and with the Senegal, Prime Minister of Kenya had also many, many problems with this. And as you said, again, of course, again, I think next time, when we in our service, we discuss a lot with to deal with conflicts in Syria and all that. We can still have a hope to have a resolution of conflict, but climate change is the law of physics. We are confronted with it. It's a fact, nothing we can do about it. From the EU, how the EU is answering to that, there is some elements. First, a global perspective. Already in 2011, the European Commission, I think, confirmed loud and clear that climate change was a driving factor for migration. And currently, we want, of course, to have a deeper knowledge on the link between the two, and we are funding a study which will be released by the end of the year by our IOM to give more scientific detail on the link between migration and climate change. And we all know, for example, that developing countries are particularly vulnerable to climate change. The economies depend more on climate sensitive natural resources. We all know that Africa is the most fragile continent. It means it's a less producer of greenhouse gas emission that will be the most impacted by a deterioration of the climate. That's why we have to deal a lot with that, and the EU does a lot with that. For example, I can give you some figures that the EU is going to finance on climate change. The EU wants to be the leader in financing. I have to stop working. I will start to say a minute. So, that's too long, just some figures. Globally, one figure only, 2014 alone, EU and its member states, there are 14 billion euros to support climate change action in developing countries. And from the Pacific Islands to the Philippines, to the Sahel, to Ethiopia. So, I'll stop here. Now, maybe the last point will be that's also we all to fight climate change, in addition to our commitment to the COP21, which are well known. We think that the technology is very important, and for us, the EU Research and Innovation Programme called Horizon 2020 is now 80 billion euros of funding. It has big part to deal with that. Now I stop here. Now the commitment of the EU, you can find them, is the EU side. Thank you.
Thank you. We want to leave time for a few questions and answers. So now we have Professor Neil Adger, Professor of Human Geography, University of Exeter. I'll follow your request and I'll give you a signal after 8 minutes.
Thank you, Nick, for the invitation as well. We've heard from elders and we've heard from diplomats, and I think it's incumbent on us as the scientific community, as social scientists here at the LSE and throughout the Academy, to provide answers to the questions, to provide the evidence for the public discourse on how we talk about these questions. It's also important for us, I think, as social scientists, to make sure that we're posing the right questions in this area, and that we use the language that we use to describe these phenomena extremely accurately and to be categorical about and reflexive in what we know and what we don't know. But the good news is, I think, is that we actually know a fair bit already. We know a fair bit about migration, how it works, what the drivers of migration are, what the social consequences of migration are, and we also have a fair understanding, I think, of why it causes such collective angst and why countries have borders, choose to put up borders, choose to open borders, and how they act. And so we can theorise, you know, we can use theory, we can use observations get to grips with this. But of course, the climate is changing, and as Nick's already outlined, the past might not be that good a guide to the future. But nevertheless, we've got to put this in context. So if there are 7 billion of us on the planet, about 1 billion of us are migrants. About 80% of that 1 billion have moved within their own country. And around about 20% of that 1 billion have moved from one country to another. The propensity for international migration is around about 3%, has been for about 2 decades now. The propensity for international migration is largely determined by how many barriers countries put up for international migration and the state of the global economy and the economic openness of that economy. But what we are most concerned about, I guess, in the context of climate change is the interplay or it's really about involuntary migration. That type of migration, that type of journey that Mary referred to, that's disrupted or is caused by or was not part of people's plans and parts of people's futures. So I've been working in this area for quite some time, and I'm working with people who've been displaced from their homes as a result of weather-related extremes. As Alain referred to, the Norwegian Refugee Council estimates around about 20 million people per year are displaced as a result of weather-related extremes every year, on average over the last decade or so. I've been talking to a number of them in Europe, specifically here in England, specifically in Somerset, in the southwest of England. And when we talk to these people, we do research with flood victims in this case, or people whose place of residence has been flooded and who've had to move. The longest period of time that people have moved in our sample of people that we're talking about is around about a year, so most people are back in their house now. And the greatest distance that someone moved was to Scotland. Now, the last time I looked, that was internal migration. And if we'd had another vote in the referendum last year, that would have been international migration. But what's common to most of that involuntary migration, that involuntary displacement associated with weather-related extremes, is the desire, obviously, for people to get on with their lives, to go back to their lives, to rebuild their homes. And we've already talked about this migration as a last resort. But that doesn't negate the human security dimensions to this, as Mary referred to, of how these types of events, whether or not people are moving, have very significant impacts on their well-being. This research that we're doing in Somerset is actually funded by the NHS, in effect, and it's about the mental health burden of being displaced from your home. So common to all this, let's call it involuntary migration, and that's what we're really dealing with here, or what we really need to focus on in the context of climate change, is the desire for this to be temporary, to return home, and for the displacement not to rupture future options, future trajectories, and future lives. But we've got to remember that, of course, involuntary migration is really only a relatively small proportion of all the movement that's going to take place because of the impacts of climate change. We might not notice it, and it's going to be basically associated with some of the other major drivers of disequilibrium in the economy, to put it in technical language, that actually causes climate change. Now, I talked about the scientific base, or the evidence base in social science for this, and I've been involved in two attempts to try and coalesce the global scientific community and also to synthesize these. First was the chief scientific advisor in the UK under his Foresight program, that's got together a community to examine the impacts of migration, or the interactions between migration and global environmental change, a few years ago. And then subsequently, I led the chapter on human security that Mary referred to for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And our co-authors, Mary, I think will be thrilled, I will report back to them, that you accurately reported on what we find in this, that climate change will have impacts on life, livelihood, well-being, non-material aspects of well-being, place, identity, and the risk of moving involuntarily from one place to another. So climate change, as Nick well knows, is about more simply than the economic aspects of everyday life. One of the key then, I've already alluded to this, one of the key drivers of migration, of course, is spatial disequilibrium in the economy. But climate change is going to affect the relative attractiveness of lots and lots of places, not just those places that are directly, whose economies are directly climate sensitive, but it's certainly going to affect that. Now, where I used to live in rural Norfolk, had a very significant community of farm workers from Portugal. So this is within Europe migration, and that's a community there. So all the projections of climate change suggest a significant drying of southern Europe, and the viability of agriculture in southern Europe being significantly challenged. Now this is the same phenomenon, the war, particularly around water scarcity, is going to affect UK agriculture. But the relative comparative advantage of the UK compared to southern Europe as a place where agriculture is going to provide food across Europe may well change. And that may well lead to a change in the demand for labour in the agricultural sector across Europe. So we might be joined by other Portuguese workers working in the fields of East Anglia. But when you talk about these, when we talk to these farmers, they actually realise they weren't agricultural workers in Portugal whenever they came here. So there is a significant demographic dynamic associated with this. One of the other key findings from a lot of this research is not the problem of migration, but the problem of immobility. So there's a very, very significant correlation between the places and populations that are exposed to the impacts of weather-related extremes and ultimately of climate change, and their lack of ability to move. So whenever you put those two together, you come up with the issue of, or the term as it's termed, the idea of trapped populations. So the issue is not that there's too much mobility, but there's actually too little choice and too much immobility. Now, I've been working in southern Bangladesh, and Alan's referred to it. Say a Dhaka has grown in about a generation from 2 million people to about 20 million people. And most of those people have moved from southern Bangladesh. They didn't really move there because of weather-related extremes, which have been fairly constant in southern Bangladesh over the last 2 decades or so, and quite a significant movement of people across the rather porous border between India and Bangladesh. The population, total fertility levels in southern Bangladesh are below replacement level. It's a stable population, but people are still moving and moving out, and they're moving to cities. The crucible of where climate change impacts are going to be in the future, in this country, in Europe, and across the world, is in cities. And the vulnerability and the exposure to risk of migrants in those cities is particularly acute. And I'll say one final point about the evidence base on involuntary migration, referring really to the conflict in Syria. Now, there is a plausible narrative doing the rounds about the 2007 to 2010 drought in Syria leading to mass rural to urban migration within, to two or three cities in northern Syria, which exacerbated civil conflict and ultimately to the civil war conflict, civil war in Syria, and then ultimately to the movement of refugees that Alain referred to. To me, so this in the climate change arena is, yes, the question I've been posed by journalists, and you've seen it all over the media, is climate change implicated in the war in Syria? To me, that is the wrong question. That is the detection question. Virtually all wars are about resources, and resources are always scarce. Most wars are about territory, and so by definition, most wars are actually about resource scarcity. And if you go looking for a climate signal in just about all resource scarcity conflicts, you'll find one. You can find one in Darfur, you can find one in Rwanda, you can find one in virtually every war conflict that you actually look for. To me, that's the wrong question. The right question here is, what's conflict actually going to do or to those places that actually makes them more vulnerable to and less able to cope not only with climate change, but with actually social progress and economic development in those sorts of places. I'll save other comments I have, but I think the principal messages here is that we know why migration happens, and it's incumbent on us to get into the detail of this, recognising, of course, that many of our theories, observations, and models, as Nick's already alluded to, the past might not be that good a guide to the future. Thank you.
The idea of track populations, immobility, cities as a crucible, involuntary migration, the few simple concepts can get you a long way. And that's what good universities do. So thank you very much indeed. Now, we are short of time. We've got only 15 minutes. So what I'm going to do is I'll take four questions, and then I'll ask our speakers to be as quick as they can in the responses. They're roving mics, so the lady up front. Could you say who we are, and could you keep your questions short, please?
Yes, thank you. Sheila Page, obviously, Development Institute. Taking up the distinction between voluntary and involuntary migration, which both Mary Robinson and Yahya made, how will this have an impact on the nature of the migrants who become, the nature of the people who become migrants, and therefore their ability to adapt in their destination country or region? Because I actually was hearing earlier today about the relatively good health of voluntary migrants. I suspect that probably is not true of involuntary migrants, and a lot of other things will be different as well.
Thank you very much. The lady just behind you, and I'll go to jump over there.
Hi, I'm Sophie Lawrence, a master's student at Imperial College London studying environmental technology. My question is primarily for Mary. I just wanted to get your perspective on how human rights law is starting to be used in courts to kind of demand climate action. both the Agenda Foundation Against the State of the Netherlands that was earlier this year, where it kind of formed part of that, and I know the Philippines have raised a case against carbon majors, and how you see some of the kind of barriers and kind of causality with some of the transboundary effects being overcome, and how we can kind of use it more, I guess, going forward.
Thank you very much. Gentleman just here.
Hi, my name's Kieran. I'm with the Green Party here in London. It's quite clear that the burden of, or the responsibility for producing carbon emissions lies heavily in the Northern Hemisphere. With the UK, for example, likely to miss its EU target of 15% of its electricity generated by renewable sources, what kind of powers does global bodies like the EU and the UN have to put pressure on national governments to actually make the effort to meet their obligations, and what kind of extra powers are we hoping to get out of the COP21 summit?
Sorry, the gentleman at the back has been patient.
Hi, Oliver Gardner, freelance journalist. We have the tools to fight desertification. We have the tools to restore large-scale damaged ecosystems. Isn't it time that we take all these amazing budgets we have for climate change, for migration, that we combine them in a joint effort to create a global workforce to restore the crisis that is climate change, which is not a technological crisis, it's a biological crisis. Cutting emissions will not stop global warming. What will stop global warming is increasing soil organic matter and restoring top soils worldwide.
Sorry, was there a question there? Yeah.
So, the question is, why aren't we doing that?
So, there are four questions, and they're big questions, and we have only 11 minutes. But the first one was on the abilities, fitness, capabilities of involuntary migrants. The second one was the role of human rights law. That's for you particularly, Mary. Then the powers of international organisations to pressure or command countries. And will Paris COP21 change that? And then lastly, worry less about cutting emissions, work more about capturing carbon in topsoils and restoring and rehabilitating land. Just on the last one, I couldn't really see why we have to choose. I mean, what the importance... I'm going to do that one. The restoring degraded land is a very important way of capturing carbon. So too is regrading forests, and they are very important. But I really can't see why they're a conspiracy against cutting emissions. And much of what we want to do as a world does involve, and Mary really stressed it very strongly, if I may say so, the integration and mitigation, adaptation and development. And you really can wind them together, and that really is the name of the game. And that was a big message, I think, from what Mary said. Anyway, I've done that one, so I'm not going to do any of the other ones. Mary, the human rights... would you like to say something about that, and what role can it play?
Okay. I think we're seeing increasingly efforts to use the courts to try to bring some enforcement into the standards. The notable case, I've forgotten the precise name, but the Dutch case recently, where you had a Dutch court applying directly the international commitment that the Netherlands was effectively binding itself by, and saying the 17% reduction in emissions is not adequate. We see that the international standard will be 25% to 40%. We'll hold you to the lowest part of that. But they were, you know, doing it in a way that would be binding. In many ways, if I can put it this way, that is kind of complicated. Trying to get human rights language into the Paris Agreement, because European countries are saying, oh dear, are we going to get new obligations? Whereas there is language that's in the Cancun agreement that all climate action should respect all human rights. And that doesn't create any new obligations, but it reinforces the fact that human rights are central to good climate policy, because you have to think about the people who are going to be affected by the policy. There is a case of teenagers in Washington State in the US who've taken action, and because they're thinking about their future. And I think we will see more and more of this. In the Philippines case, as was mentioned, you know, I think it's always a sign that the regulatory system is slightly weak, that we have to use courts to try to enforce. But it, I think we will see more and more imaginative cases, and also the science is becoming clearer. You know, the impacts of climate change are becoming clearer, because the problem of causality has always been the problem. And I think as that becomes clearer, we'll probably see more and more litigation. Can I also make a comment on the very thoughtful question about the voluntary and involuntary migration?
Cool.
I think there's no doubt that voluntary migrants are very often very entrepreneurial. They're the very people you want to have come to your country, because they are travelling to express themselves, to see the world, to engage, and they come with a good mindset on that. The involuntarily displaced are distressed, maybe have lost family members, have lost possessions, are in terrible state, and so are much less likely to be resilient in that sense.
Could I ask you to say something? Thank you very much, Mary. Say something about the powers of the EU and the UN in relation to member states, and whether that is likely to be changed in any way by COP21. And of course, any other question. But also, Neil, if I could ask you also about the potential weaknesses or difficulties of involuntary migrants.
Mm.
But again, feel free to comment on others too. So,
just one small note on involuntary migrants. The Syrian refugees are involuntary migrants, and even some of them were very much welcomed in Germany, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Even the patronat, the BDI in Germany, said, of course, they are young people, they are enthusiastic. Even involuntary migrants can be welcomed.
Mm-hmm.
Necessary. That's yeah. Now, on the commitment, the commitment, how to deal with commitments. It's clear that the EU wants what we call a legally binding agreement in Paris. It's not yet achieved. We want that. Of course, it was not the case for Kyoto. If you speak of legally binding agreement, then, of course, you will have then sanctions if you don't respect your targets, your INDC, the intended nationally determined contribution. So now more than 140 countries all over the world have...
160.
Yes, but not the main oil producers.
Okay.
But we have Russia, China, of course, the US on this. So 2 points will be legally binding agreement, so it means sanctioned. And second, a 5-year, what we want to achieve, a 5-year running clause. So true that even today, we'll see in 5 years where we are, maybe we have to strengthen the commitment and maybe to strengthen the sanction if necessary. So that's... But that's not determined. It's a very big part of the COP21 negotiation when we see where we are at the end of the year.
Thank you. Neil.
Thank you. The first question about involuntary migrants, the answer has already been given. But it's got to be said that voluntary migrants or traditional or standard regular migration, if you look at the population level, tend to be... Well, because of their demographic, because of people move at working age, and the rest of it tend to be less burdens on the states than regular populations, because there's less elderly people, and contribute to economies, contribute to cultural life, and the rest of it, and that's an absolute no-brainer. But in terms of involuntary migration, particularly people displaced because of weather-related extremes, one of the key issues in terms of international cooperation is the demand for humanitarian assistance. I think going forward, DFID here in the UK have already flagged this and highlighted this in a review by Paddy Ashton a couple of years ago, and this is something being highlighted in the climate change risk assessment going on by the Committee on Climate Change presented to Parliament next year, which is that the risk of climate change causing displacement of people around the world isn't just about people coming to the UK or even people coming to Europe. It's about the demand for humanitarian assistance and our interactions and our solidarity with people all around the world. And one final point I would make in terms of Paris COP and the rest of it, what Nick said right at the start, which is we absolutely have to avoid 3 degrees or anything above 2 degrees at all costs. And I say that at all costs, because every single bit of science that on terms of projections and impacts means that that all of these will be, you know, will in effect redraw the maps of the world. And when we redraw the maps of the world, there are lots of things, lots of consequences that are potentially unforeseen that flow from those.
Thank you very much. And can I add just one word on Paris? Ambassador Rudy Berman could have done it, but since I'm sitting here, I'll do it. And I am an ami du cher for Laurent. There's a small group of about 10 of us, ami du cher for Laurent. Essentially, the Paris Alliance for Climate Action is actually open for new baptism, if you have another special way of explaining it. But currently, it's the Paris Alliance for Climate Action. It's got four pillars. The first pillar is the text. And the text is binding. The text is what you are obligated to do in terms of sharing your information, reconvening to compare, follow methods for doing calculations and reporting. And that's binding. The second pillar is the intended nationally determined contributions. I mean, very political language, but understandably so. And that is intended. It is not binding. And it has not been seen as something that would be binding for a very long time. The fact that the intended national term contributions are not binding is not news. It has been the understanding for a very long time. But they are nonetheless, it seems to me, very serious propositions. If you look back at Copenhagen, Cancun, where the numbers came in for Copenhagen in the early months of 2010, Copenhagen having been December 2009, people promised to send in their numbers. They did, actually. And on the whole, they've stuck with them. Certainly the EU, China, and United States look like meeting what they said they would intend to do in the early months of 2010, right after Copenhagen, and that was put into the Cancun Agreement at the end of that year in December 2010. So the fact that they're intended and not formally binding, you know, not enforced by a court in Mars and a police force from Venus, they are nevertheless very serious statements. And it's going to be, Chinese is going to be put into the 13th five-year plan, which is beginning to be released. So I think it's very important to recognize that. The third pillar is around finance, which will be around intentions and commitments, but not, as it were, formally binding. I was part of the group that negotiated in Copenhagen the flow of $100 billion per annum by 2020, working with Prime Minister Meles and Hillary Clinton's team. That is not binding. That was flows from rich countries to poor countries, public and private money. But it looks as if that may well be, I mean, you have to think about how to interpret the numbers, but if that looks like it will likely be met. But that's an example, that was for 2020, that's not so much part of this one, although it will affect the environment, because we're talking about 2030 for COP21. And the last one is the action agenda. It's the least well-defined, but in many ways it's the most exciting. It's coalitions of mayors, and Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, is playing a very powerful leading role in that. It's coordination of business people, many big firms getting together to share ideas. It'll be around innovation, and we expect Bill Gates and President Obama and Prime Minister Modi to be on the platform on November 30th to talk about that. So that those are the four pillars. It's only the first that is legally binding. But the other three really matter, and they're issues of substance. So many of us would have wanted much stronger intended nationally determined contributions. If we ruled the world, they would have been stronger. Well, the world is probably fortunate, it's not ruled by some of us. But nevertheless, I do think that what we're seeing emerging is going to be a real turning point, and then the questions that arise, and they arise within Paris, within COP21, is how fast is the acceleration going to be? It's the road from Paris, but I hope in Paris we chart a lot of the road from Paris. So that's, I hope I've done my job as Amy Boucher, just by relating that. But we're so close to Paris, I thought perhaps I should add something on that. Anyway, now it's time for a glass of wine. You always have to say one glass of wine with students, but I don't think they're going to be counted. it's so produced just outside here in the foyer. Could I thank again all those who worked so hard to make this happen, the three LSE institutes that I mentioned, European Institute, Institute of Global Affairs, Grantham Institute. Thank you again to the Embassy of France, to the European Commission representative in the UK. Thank you, Eric, for being, as they say in India, the life force behind this. But most of all, thank you very much to our panelists. Thank you.